All right, Prince, Jake interrupted. Tell us what more you want from us. Tell us, is there any way we get out of here with a safe conduct and our money? The prince smiled warmly at Jake, leaning to pat his arm.
Always the pragmatist. No time wasted in tearing the hair or beating the breast, Mr. Barton.
Shoot, said Jake.
My father and I would be grateful if you would work for us for a 6-month contract.
Why 6 months? Demanded Gareth.
By then, all will be lost or won.
Go on, Jake invited.
For 6 months you will exercise your skills for us and teach us how best to defend ourselves against a modern army. Service, maintain, and command the armored cars.
In return? Jake asked.
A princely salary for the 6 months, a safe conduct out of Ethiopia, and your money guaranteed by a London bank at the end of that time.
What is fair wages for putting one's head on the butcher's block? Gareth asked bitterly.
Double.
Another £7,000 each, said the prince without hesitation. And the men on each side of him relaxed slightly and exchanged glances.
Each? Asked Gareth.
Each, agreed Lige Michael.
I only wish my lawyer was here to draw up the contract, said Gareth.
Not necessary,
Michael laughed, and he shook his head and drew 2 envelopes from his robes. He handed 1 to each of them.
Bank guaranteed checks, Lloyd's of London. Irrevocable, I assure you, but post-dated 6 months ahead. Valid on the 1st of February next year.
The 2 white men examined the documents curiously. Carefully, Jake checked the date on the bank draft, 1st of February 1936, and then read the figure, £14,000 sterling only, and he grinned. Exact amount. The precise date. He shook his head admiringly. You had it all figured out. Man, you were thinking weeks ahead of us.
Good God, Toffee. Gareth intoned mournfully.
I must say I'm appalled, utterly appalled.
Does that mean you refuse, Major Swales?
Gareth glanced at Jake, and a flash of agreement passed between them. Gareth sighed theatrically.
Well, I must say that I did have an appointment in Madrid. They've got themselves a little war they're working on, but...
And here he studied the bank draft again.
But one war is very much like another. And furthermore, you have given me some fairly powerful reasons why I should stay on.
Gareth withdrew the wallet from his inside pocket and folded the draft into it.
However, that doesn't alter the fact that I'm utterly appalled by the way this whole business has been conducted.
And you made it, Mr. Barton?
Lige Michael asked. As my partner has just remarked... £14,000 isn't exactly peanuts.
Yeah, I accept.
The prince nodded, and then his expression changed, became bleak and savage.
I must urge you most cogently not to attempt to leave Ethiopia before the expiry of our agreement. Justice is crude but effective under my father's administration.
At that moment, the gentleman under discussion lifted the sword high above his head and then drove the point deep into the earth between his feet. He left it there, the blade shivering and gleaming in the firelight, and staggered, wheezing and cackling, to his place between Jake and Gareth. He flung a skinny old arm around each of them and greeted them with a hug and an affectionate cry of, "How do you do?" And Gareth cocked a speculative eye at him.
"How'd you like to learn to play gin rummy, old son?" he asked kindly.
6 months was a lot of time to while away, and there might yet be further profit in the situation, he thought. The sound of the drums woke Count Aldo Belli from a deep, untroubled sleep. He lay and listened to them for a while, to the deep, monotonous rhythm, like the pulse of the earth itself, and the effect was lulling and hypnotic. Then suddenly the Count came fully awake, and the adrenaline poured hotly into his bloodstream. A month before leaving Rome, He'd attended a screening of the latest Hollywood release, Trader Horn, an African epic of wild animals and bloodthirsty tribesmen. The sound of tribal drums had been skillfully used on the soundtrack to heighten the sense of menace and suspense, and the Count now realized that out there in the night the same terrible drums were beating. He came out of his bed in a single bound with a roar that woke those in the camp who were still asleep. When Gino rushed into the tent, he found his master standing stark naked and wild-eyed in the center of his tent, with the ivory-handled Beretta in one hand and the jeweled dagger clutched in the other. The instant the drums began beating, Luigi Castellani hurried back to the bivouac, for he knew exactly what reaction to expect from his colonel. He arrived to find that the Count was fully uniformed, had selected a bodyguard of 50 men, and was on the point of embarking in the waiting rolls. The engine was running, and the driver was as eager to leave as his august passenger. The Count was not at all pleased to see the bulky figure of his major come hurrying out of the darkness with that unmistakable swaggering gait. He'd hoped to get clear before Castellani could intervene, and now he immediately went on the offensive.
Major, I am returning to Asmara to report in person to the general, shouted Aldobelli,
and tried to reach the rolls. But the major was too nimble for him and interposed his bulk and saluted.
"My colonel, the defences of the wells are now complete," he reported. "The area is secure."
"I shall report that we are being attacked in overwhelming force," cried the Count,
and tried to duck around Castellani's right side. But the major anticipated the move and jumped sideways to keep belly to belly.
"The men are dug in and in good spirits. You have my permission to withdraw in good order, under the enemy's bloodthirsty assault."
The Count attempted to lull the man with the prospect of escape, and then lunged to the left to reach the rolls. But the Major was swift as a mamba, and again they faced each other. The entire officer corps of the 3rd Battalion, hastily dressed and alarmed by the drums in the night, had assembled to watch this exhibition of agility, as the Count and Castellani jumped backwards and forwards like a pair of gamecocks, sparring at each other. Their sentiments were heavily on the side of their colonel, and they would have enjoyed nothing more than the spectacle of the retreating rolls. They would then have been free to follow in haste.
"I do not believe the enemy is present in any force." Castellani's voice was raised to a level where the Count's protests were completely drowned. "However, it is essential that the colonel takes command in person. If there is to be a confrontation, it will involve a valued judgment."
The major pressed forward a step at a time until his chest was an inch from the colonel's and their noses almost touched.
"We are not formally at war. Your presence is essential to reinforce our position."
The colonel was pressed to the point where he had no choice but to fall back a pace, and the watching officers sighed sadly. It was an act of capitulation. The contest of wills was over. And although the Count continued to protest weakly, the Major worked him away from the rolls the way a good sheepdog handles its flock.
"It will be dawn in an hour," said Castellani, "and as soon as it is light, we shall be in a position to evaluate the situation."
At that moment, the drums fell silent. Up the valley in the craves, the Ras has at last finished his dance of defiance, and to the Count the silence was cheering. He threw one last wistful look at the rolls, and then let his gaze wander to the 50 heavily armed men of his bodyguard, and took a little more heart. He squared his shoulders and drew himself erect, throwing back his head.
"Major," he snapped, "the battalion will stand firm."
He turned to his watching officers, all of whom tried to fade into insignificance to avoid his eyes.
"Major Vito, take command of this detachment and move forward to clear the ground. The rest of you, fall in around me."
The colonel gave the major and his 50 stalwarts a respectable lead so that they might draw any hostile fire, and then, surrounded by a protective screen of his reluctant juniors and prodded forward by Luigi Castellani, he moved cautiously along the dusty path that wound down the slope to the valley, where the battalion's forward elements had been so expertly entrenched. The most junior of Ras Golam's multitudinous grooms was 15 years of age. The previous day, one of the Ras's favourite mares in his care had snapped her halter rope while he was taking her down to the water. She galloped out into the desert, and the boy had followed her for the whole of that day and half of the night, until the capricious creature had allowed him to come up with her and grasp the trailing end of the rope. Exhausted by the long chase and chilled by the cold night wind, the boy had huddled down on her neck and allowed the mare to pick her own way back to the waterhole. He was half asleep, clinging by instinct alone to the mare's mane, when a short while before dawn she wandered into the perimeter of the Italian base. A nervous sentry had challenged loudly, and the startled animal had plunged into a full run through the outskirts of the camp. Now, fully awake, the boy had clung to the galloping horse and seen the lines of parked trucks and military tents looming out of the darkness. He'd seen the stacked rifles and recognized the shape of the helmet of another sentry who had challenged again as they passed through the outer lines. Peering back under his own arm, he'd seen the flash of the rifle shot and heard the crack of the bullet pass his bowed head, and he urged the horse on with heels and knees. By the time the groom reached the deep wadi, the Ras's following was at last succumbing to the effects of a full night's festivities. Many of them had drifted away to find a place to sleep. Others had merely huddled down in their robes and slept where they'd eaten. Only the hardened few still ate and drank, argued and sang, or sat in tedge-numbed silence about the fires, watching the womenfolk begin to prepare the morning meal. The boy flung himself off the mare at the entrance to the caves, ducked under the arms of the sentries, who would have restrained him, and ran into the crowded, smoky and dimly lit interior. He was gabbling with fright and importance, the words tumbling over each other again and again and making no sense, until Lige Mikhail caught him by the upper arms and shook him to restore his senses. Then the story he told made sense and rang with urgent conviction. Those within earshot shouted it to those further back, and within seconds the story, distorted and garbled, had flashed through the gathering and was running wildly through the whole encampment. The sleepers awakened, every man armed, and every woman and child curious and voluble. They streamed out of the caves and from the rough tents and shelters in the narrow ravines, without command, moving like a shoal of fish without a leader, but with a single purpose, laughing skeptically, or shouting speculation and comment and query, brandishing shields and ancient firearms, the women clutching their infants, and the older children dancing around them, or darting ahead. The shapeless mob streamed out of the broken ground and down into the saucer-shaped valley of the wells. In the caves, Lige Mikhail was still explaining the boy's story to the foreigners, and arguing the details and implications with them and his father. It was Jake Barton who realized the danger. If the Italians had sent in a unit to grab the wells, then it's a calculated act of war. They'll be looking for trouble, Prince. You best forbid any of your men to go down there until we've sized up the situation properly. It was too late, far too late, in the first faint glimmer of dawn, when the light plays weird tricks on a man's eyes. The Italian sentries, peering over their parapets, saw a wall of humanity swarming out of the dark and broken ground, and heard the rising hubbub of hundreds of excited voices. When the drumming had begun, many of the black shirts were huddled below the firing step of their trenches, swaddled in their greatcoats and sleeping the exhausted sleep of men who travelled all previous day and worked all the night. The non-commissioned officers kicked and pulled them to their feet and shoveled them to their positions along the parapet. From here they peered, befuddled with sleep, down into the valley. With the exception of Luigi Castellani, not a single man in the 3rd Battalion had ever faced an armed enemy. And now, after an infinity of nerve-tearing waiting, at last the experience was upon them, in the dark, before the dawn, when a man's vitality is at its lowest ebb. Their bodies were chilled and their brains unclear, In the uncertain light, the mob that poured into the valley was as numerous as the sands of the desert, each figure as large as a giant and as ferocious as a marauding lion. It was at this moment that Colonel Aldo Belli, panting with exertion and nervous strain, stepped out of the narrow communication trench onto the firing platform of the forward line of emplacements. The sergeant in command of the trench recognized him instantly and let out a cry of relief.
"Oh, my colonel, thank God you have come."
And forgetful of rank and position, he seized the count's arm. Aldo Belli was so busy trying to fight off the man's sweating and importunate clutches that it was some seconds before he actually glanced down into the darkened valley. Then his bowels turned to jelly, and his legs seemed to buckle under him.
"Merciful Mother of God," he wailed. "All is lost. They are upon us."
With clumsy fingers, he unbuckled the flap of his holster. As he fell to his knees, he drew the pistol.
"Fire!" he screamed. "Open fire!"
And crouching down, well below the level of the parapet, he emptied the Beretta straight upwards into the dawn sky. Manning the Italian parapets were over 400 combatants. Of these, over 350 were riflemen, armed with magazine-loaded bolt-action weapons, while another 60 men in teams of five serviced the cunningly placed machine guns. Every man of this force had endured grinding nervous strain, listening to the war drums, and now confronted by a sweeping mob of threatening figures. They crouched like dark statues behind their weapons, fingers curled stiffly around the triggers, and squinted over the open sights of rifle and machine gun. The count's shriek of command and the crackle of the pistol shots were all that was necessary to snap the paralyzing bonds of fear that held them. The firing was started around Aldo Belli's position by men close enough to hear his command. A long line of muzzle flashes bloomed and twinkled along the forward slope of the valley, and three machine guns opened with them. The tearing sound of their long traversing bursts drowned out the crackle of musketry, and their tracer flickered and flew in long white arcs out across the valley to bury itself in the dark moving blot of humanity. Taken in flank, the mob broke and surged away towards the dark silence of the far slope of the valley, away from the sheets of bright white tracer and the red rows of rifle fire. Leaving their dead and wounded scattered behind them, they spread like spilled oil across the valley floor. The silent gunners on the far slope saw them coming, held their fire for a few more confused, panic-soured moments, and then, seeing themselves threatened, they opened also. The delay had the effect of allowing the survivors of the first volley to race deeply into the fields of overlapping fire that Castellani had so cleverly planned. Caught in the open ground, hemmed in by a murderous storm of fire, the forward movement of the mob broke down, and they milled aimlessly, the women shrieking and clutching at their children, the children darting and doubling like a shoal of fish trapped in a tidal pool, some of the warriors kneeling in the open and beginning at last to return fire. The red flashes of the black powder were long and dull and smoky and ineffectual against men in entrenched positions. They served only to intensify the ferocity of the Italian attack. Now the surge of uncontrolled, panic-stricken humanity slowed and eventually ceased. The unarmed women, who still survived, gathered their children and covered them with their robes, crouching down over them, as a mother hen does with her chicks. And the men crouched also, firing blindly and wildly up the slopes of the valley at the muzzle flashes that were fading now as the sun rose and the light strengthened. 12 machine guns, each firing almost 700 rounds a minute, and 350 rifles, poured a sheet of bullets down into the valley. Minute after minute, the firing continued, and slowly the light strengthened, unmercifully exposing the survivors in the valley below. The mood of the attackers changed. From panicky, nervously strung-out green militia, they were transformed. The almost drunken elation of victorious attackers gripped them. They were laughing triumphantly now as they served the guns, their eyes bright with the bloodlust of the predator. The knowledge that they could kill without retribution made them bold and cruel. The miserable popping and flashing of ancient muskets in the valley below them was so feeble, so lacking in menace, that not a man among them was still afraid. Even Count Aldo Belli was now on his feet, brandishing his pistol and shouting with a high, almost girlish hysteria, "Death to the enemy! Fire! Keep firing!" And cautiously he lifted his head another inch above the parapet. "Kill them! Ours is the victory!" The valley floor, as the first rays of sunlight touched it, was covered with thick swathes of the dead and maimed. They lay scattered, singly, piled in clumps like mounds of old clothing, in a flea market, thrown haphazardly on the pale sandy earth, or arranged in neat patterns like fish on the slab. In the center of the killing ground, there was still life and movement. Here and there, a figure might leap up and run with robes flapping, and immediately the machine guns would follow it, quick stabbing spouts of dust closing swiftly until they met and held on the running figure, when it would collapse and roll on the sandy earth. The warriors, who still crouched over their ancient rifles, with their dark faces lifted to the slopes, were now providing good practice for the riflemen above them. The Italian officers' voices, high-pitched and excited, called down fire upon them, and swiftly each of these defiants was hit by carefully aimed fire and fell, some of them kicking and twitching. The firing had lasted about 20 minutes now, and there were few targets still on offer. The machine guns traversed expectantly, firing short bursts into the heaped carcasses, shattering already mutilated flesh, or tore clouds of dust and flying shale from the rounded lips of the deep water holes, from the cover of which a sporadic fire still popped and crackled. "My colonel!" Castellani touched Aldo Belli's arm to gain his attention, and at last he turned, wild-eyed and elated, to his major.
"Ah, Castellani, what a victory! What a great victory, hey? They will not doubt our valor now."
"Colonel, shall I order the ceasefire?" And the Count seemed not to hear him.
They will know now what kind of soldier I am. This brilliant victory will win for me a place in the halls.
Colonel, we must cease fire now. This is a slaughter. Order the ceasefire." Aldo Belli stared at him, his face beginning to flush with outrage.
"You crazy fool!" he shouted. "The battle must be decisive, crushing. We will not cease now, not until the victory is ours."
He was stuttering wildly, and his hand shook as he pointed down into the bloody shambles of the valley.
"The enemy have taken cover in the waterholes. They must be flushed out and destroyed. Mortars, Castellani, bomb them out!"
Aldo Belli did not want it to end. It was the most deeply satisfying experience of his life. If this was war, he knew at last why the ages and the poets had invested it with such glory. This was man's work, and Aldo Belli knew himself born to it.
"Do you not question my orders?" he shrieked at Castellani. "To your duty, immediately!"
"Immediately," Castellani repeated bitterly, and for a moment longer stared stonily into the Count's eyes before he turned away. The first mortar bomb climbed high into the clear desert dawn before arcing over and dropping vertically down into the valley. It burst on the lip of the nearest well. It kicked up a brief column of dust and smoke, and the shrapnel whinnied shrilly. The second bomb fell squarely into the deep circular pit, bursting out of sight below ground level. Mud and smoke gushed upwards, and out of the waterhole into the open ground crawled and staggered three scarecrow figures with their tattered and dirty robes fluttering like flags of truce. Instantly the rifle fire and the machine gun fire burst over them, and the earth around them, whipped by the bullets, seemed to liquefy into a cascade of flying dust into which they tumbled and at last lay still. Aldo Belli let out a hoot of excitement. It was so easy and so deeply satisfying.
"The other holes, Castellani," he screamed. "Clean them out, all of them."
Concentrating their fire on one hole at a time, the mortars ranged in swiftly. Some of the holes were deserted, but at most of them, the slaughter was continued. A few survivors of the shimmering burst of shrapnel staggered out into the open to be cut down swiftly by the waiting machine guns. The Count was by now so emboldened that he climbed up on the parapet, the better to view the field and watch the mortars fire on the remaining holes, and to direct the machine gunners. The hole nearest the wadis and broken ground at the head of the valley was the next target, and the first bomb was over, crumping in a tall jump of dust and pale flame. Before the next bomb fell, a woman jumped up over the lip and tried to reach the mouth of the wadi. Behind her, she dragged a child or two of 3 years, a naked toddler with fat little bow legs and a belly like a brown ball. He couldn't keep up with the mother and lost his footing, so she dragged him, wailing along the sandy earth. Straddling her hip and clutched with desperate strength to her breast was another younger infant, also naked, also wailing and kicking frantically. For several seconds, the running, heavily burdened woman drew no fire, and then a burst from a machine gun fell about her, and a bullet struck and severed the arm by which she held the child. She staggered in a circle, shrieking dementedly, and waving the stump of the arm like the spout of a garden hose. The next burst smashed through her chest, the same bullets shattering the body of the infant on her hip, and she fell and rolled like a rabbit hit by a shotgun. The guns fell silent again, and remained silent, while the naked toddler stood up uncertainly. He began to wail again, standing solidly at last on the fat, dimpled legs, a string of blue beads around the tightly bulging belly, and his penis sticking out like a tiny brown finger. From the mouth of the wadi emerged a running horse, a raw-boned and rangy white stallion, galloping heavily over the sandy ground, with a frail boyish figure lying low along its neck, a black shammer flying out wildly behind. The rider drove the stallion on towards where the child stood weeping, and had almost covered the open ground before the gunners realized what was happening. The first machine gun traversed on the galloping animal, but this lead-off was stiff, and the bullets kicked dust, slightly high and behind. Then the horse reached the child, and the rider reined in sharply, sending it rearing on his hind quarters, and the rider swung down to make the pickup. At that moment, two other machine guns opened up on the stationary target.